The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Without the request, which it would be for all you guys back there to move down here and huddle around the fires of learning. Just so, it's going to be actually my claim down that would be we're also not completely sure.
Yeah, you really do want to.
I know you don't. I know that this is a real process. This violates every human being that's five by five of those people are supposed to. And we're also not completely sure whether or not the human gap is coming down, so we thought rather than to lead us launch into stuff. And then if David gets in a little bit, then we'll actually break into some sort of interview with anything he needs to tell us about this.
My name is Ken Anderson. I teach in the international business curriculum and generally curriculum. I have Marcus here with me that teaches on the public international law side. And so we're two of the folks that do public and private international law here at WCL. We represent actually an enormous faculty that leads all of our fellow law schools sort of in the dust, I guess you would say. But we're sort of standing in for all of them. So maybe the best thing would be if we each said a little bit about has a curriculum for the private international law side and the public international law side. I saw whether David came in to sort of say anything with this one to the questions you guys as far as what's working on. So
that sounds okay.
And I'm pleased to say that, well, actually, I'm embarrassed to say that my notes from my earlier class today are still up on the board. It's not a race like the purposes, and Karma has not caught up with me, so my own notes are in the way. All right. Private international law covers a whole range of sort of mixed up topics that sort of all merge together in some way. So it includes genuine rules of international law on private business transactions. And within our curriculum, the class that's most important for that, sort of the intro class into that, would be the international business transactions class that I teach and a couple other people teach as well. And for a lot of students, this serves as sort of gateway class, not just in international business stuff, but actually in the transactions and the idea of how business actually operates. So for many students, this is kind of an introduction of a certain kind of transactional business and business planning. I think about how different private businesses would wind up entering into transactional relationships, how they draft contracts, how they sort of do all these things. Second area that this area covers is actually one that is in some ways better thought of as being public law, so we sort of think of it on the private side. And this would be our class in the intro to international trade that covers the basic rules of the international trading system. And I say that it's kind of public, kind of private, because the rules of international trade obviously govern what private parties do, what companies do, what corporations do, what people do in the trading stuff. But the rules themselves actually come out of a series of public law treaties. So in that sense, it's both public and private kind of mixed together. Okay, so this covers transactional corporate business planning of a certain kind. This covers the rules on trade that govern these private parties as between states that are trying to sort of work cross-border. And then the third general area would be disputes distinction of classes that, unlike these other two, is really dealing with the questions of how parties mitigate their disputes across border and across border economic law issues with each other. Where do you take the thing to court? What's the process by which the dispute is heard? Will it be heard in the court of law? Will it be arbitration of some kind? A whole series of classes that we offer to deal with dispute resolution, arbitration, investment arbitration, and a long series of classes. So generally speaking, I'd say that our private international law classes, by and large, fall into one of these three categories. And then many of them also cross, as Professor Arnold mentioned, explained in relation to the human rights and business process. There's crossover as well. Of these things, this is, for this category, we gave the classification. On the trade and investment stuff, this is the gateway class in. And then you can sort of pick, there's no sort of basic class in the dispute resolution side. You can kind of pick the topic that interests you in those kinds of like a dispute resolution, litigation, arbitration kind of classes. Now, one last thing before I close this part of it, which is, I think many, many students have a burning interest in international law practice, including on the private international law side. As JD students in particular, one thing to bear in mind is your value to a client in a cross-border transaction is set in the first place by your ability to give them advice about American law, which you've got your JD in the past. So you want to be careful that as you take these kinds of incredibly cool classes, especially because college has letters, that you do not wind up neglecting the basic bread and butter core of the private law curriculum domestically. So corporations law, securities regulation, the law of debt and borrowing money. These are the things that your clients will expect you to know really, really thoroughly. And then they expect you, on top of that, to be able to put that into other people's deals. So taking a pure diet of this stuff will not actually lead you sufficiently better than the law of the U.S. legal system to deal with the clients in an expected way. So you have to think of this as being sort of the add-on that gives you. It's like those alien movies where the two aliens land on one back and on your back and they're give us some copies and tentacles and they link up and put together. Yeah. What you want to be is one of those aliens looking up at another of those aliens. These classes are designed to provide these tentacles that come together. But it's mostly not about the tentacles, it's mostly about the other part of that.
Wow, that's fascinating. No, I'm Diane Orr Fisher. I'm going to say just a little bit because, first of all, some of you know, because I have you in my international law classes. I've been away for several years, so I'm less deep to the curriculum here than my colleagues at the center at this moment in time. But why don't I say a few things and what I think I can do most helpful is try to respond to your questions. And the kinds of questions I tend to be asked most often from students is how to structure their selection of courses given their interest. So I'll say a little bit about that. I'll make a few very general points, but I think it can probably be more helpful or responding to some of your questions. One question I'm often asked is whether students should take the introductory international law class, and if so, when, where that question comes from, I think, is that a lot of students have heard somewhere that you don't need to take the introductory class. You'll pick up through more specific classes the basics of international law, and you don't need to waste a whole course on the basics. I have a bit of a bias since I do teach the introductory international law, but based on my own experience, I am convinced it's invaluable as a foundation for other classes to take an introductory international law class. And here's what my own experience and perspective. I didn't take it, and I went to law school that had a great reputation in international law. I had no idea I was going to practice in the area. And some of the great professors were on leave. The professor I might have otherwise taken them, or something like that. For a variety of reasons, I didn't. And I practiced nothing but international law for over 30 years. So I've picked up, and I've taught it for a long time as well. I do know that it's true that you can pick it up, even if you didn't take an introductory law class. But it's a lot more work, and you don't know how much you don't know until you start practicing. And you discover, oh my gosh, this really basic framework and treaties work and all that really is important to know. And so I strongly believe that if you think you want a career in international law or even might, it's a useful foundation. I also think it's an incredibly useful foundation for more specific classes. It's possible here to take advanced or specialized international law classes without a prerequisite. A lot of us offer classes in a way that will work whether or not you've taken an international law class already. But my experience is that my students miss a lot if they haven't already had international law. So you can do it. I spend more time outside of class than I do in specialized international law classes who didn't take an introductory class, helping them catch up. A way to catch up, but you still miss a lot. So I have only one sort of very specific piece of advice, which is that if you're interested in career, it's worth taking an introductory international law class, and I would recommend doing that as soon as possible because it will enable you to get more out of the specialized class than if you have to do that. The other sort of general suggestion I very much in line with Professor Anderson, which is that in every specialized area of international law that I'm familiar with, it's incredibly important to bring to the work you do an expertise in a specialized area of law that's not international law. So, for example, I do a lot of work with international criminal law. If you're somebody who's interested in that field, one of the best things you can do is become an expert in criminal procedure and substantive criminal law, as well as areas of international, public international law, an area that would be also highly relevant to that, which is a part of public international law, international humanitarian law. People actually think that in we have an American that bridges. Professor Bob Goldman teaches a class in international humanitarian law. He and Professor Anderson are both recognized experts in the whole world in this area. So if you're interested in that particular area, international criminal law, you should take it in faculty. But any other examples I would give, I think, would be specific to areas you're interested in. I'm sorry, I do want to make one other general point. To be more useful for your trying to respond to your specific questions. And I've said this to several of you in one-on-one conversations, but the question I get asked most often, other than the one I already mentioned, is how do you actually break into the field? And the answer I always give, it's really true, is that you have an opportunity while you're a student that you won't have again in the future to take advantage of possibilities, externship possibilities, summer programs, some of which pay, many of which don't, but where you can get your foot in the door in an institution, and that is much, 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 much more likely to hire you after you graduate because you've done an internship or externship than if you haven't. And those kinds of programs are often helpful in getting positions in the field generally, even if there's not an opportunity to turn an internship at an organization like the State Department into a full-time job. The fact that you have the internship there will really carry you some way
More for Professor Anderson, but do you find that it's easier to take the private business transactions class after business associations or concurrently with one of the sort of basics in the American corporate?
I'm not sure that all the IBT sections are taught this way, but I teach normally the IBT section all with an explicit recognition that there were many students who were taking business associations alongside them. So I don't require any prior M2, but I strongly encourage people to be taking BA concurrently and think that I designed it as a survey class that's designed for first semester, second year students who haven't necessarily had anything beyond being the only one offered. I'm not sure that if you offer them a I actually also just underlined the externship and all that stuff as well for the private law side. But the enormous advantage of being in Washington as a law school is we've got the opportunity to do these externships in all these different agencies during the school year. And that enables
I don't know that it's a general answer to your question. I think that there are very specific answers depending on areas of international
interest. What I would say is we do have this sort of joint that you've heard on up there, but even short of that, you are allowed to take up to 6 units even without being in sort of an additional master's program up on the main campus in areas that are relevant to whatever your studies are. So there are courses, I do know David Bosco teaches stuff on the United Nations, for example, the well-known scholar in this area. So they've got very, very good course offerings up there. And even without signing up for the MA program, you can take, say, at least 2-3 courses. The person to talk with about this would be Professor Paul Williams, who runs that program. There's also that one.
So similar to the private international law, are there, other than a specific interest area, are there non-international classes that we should take for public international law careers?
Again, I think it depends on the kind of,
although Professor Anderson has presented himself as the expert for good reason in the private international law,
I think it does depend in part on what area you think you're going to
practice in. This is,
will seem like a non-responsive answer.
If you think you're interested in working in international organizations,
I think it's useful to take the class in the law of international organizations. I think to have taken that class and gone to work at the school bank or the OAS, whatever the initial education, have told me that they found the preparation in the class way more useful than they thought, because they just thought it was interesting stuff. It's actually good preparation. But in terms of other areas, you know, it does depend on what area you go into. If it's human rights, and a lot of people do come here with a human rights interest, I think it's actually helpful to take some of the classes that Professor Anderson teaches, because to be an effective advocate of human rights today, it's really important to understand the larger context in which advocacy takes place, and being able to reconcile a human rights agenda with international trade concerns that are also going to influence the decision and policy. Beyond that, I think it really does come on the area. I mean, I gave one specific example. So just to go back, if you're interested in working in international humanitarian law, besides taking international humanitarian law and general public international law, I would suggest that you take criminal law, criminal procedure, comparative law, and that would be but that's a very specific recommendation.
Whether
know, there's
ways to maintain how hard it is to cover even the topic of the semester of international law. And so there's 10 fundamentals, whether you're teaching them as your elective or second year. And then that class is offered.
I'm not sure what
I don't actually know enough about the MA requirements specifically to address on the high structure conditions to adopt something. But I do talk to Paul. On the private side of it, I'm focusing on domestic law classes. Besides BA, what other one should we be focusing on next down the list?
I would assume tax, maybe?
Right. Tax, oddly enough, we lots and lots and lots of people wanted to take the tax law class in their second year. Speaking of business law professor, I'm always stunned by how complicated tax examples are if you actually haven't had some of the business classes. I think we just need to think in terms of the general business buyer as those security regulations, related to general commercial law. If you look on the website, there's a sort of business curriculum that Snyder has laid out for the domestic business buyer. And basically, it's got the initial courses in that.
Just general administrative law, the class, how valuable do you think it would be for both kind of private and public, generally?
Justin Wilson, do you have an opinion about this?
Yes. I don't know what the question is.
Oh, sorry. administrative law as a general class for either the public or the private side of the curriculum. I guess I'm not sure that I think it's that. I think it's a hugely important class. It's one that we excel at. Again, our Washington plan gives us a lot of access to that. Specifically, from the standpoint of international law, it's a very, very inside the government sort of class that doesn't really quite have sort of a content in this study. I think it's a hugely important class, but not necessarily.
I agree. Hi, I'm Rick Wilson. I'm the director of the Human Rights Clinic, and you're her advising, I guess. Did this start at 4:30? 4. I had it on my calendar for 4:30, so I apologize for being a half hour late. And I was down in another class watching one of our visiting colleagues from Serbia talk about the dissolution of the Yugoslav Republic. Very interesting. maybe too much. But in any event, on that question, I think one of my own takes on advising is about clinic and other experientially related courses, and
we haven't touched on
that at all. And I do want to talk about that a little bit, but it maybe this is the question is a
segue into it.
When we do work in the Human Rights Clinic, some part of our docket is in asylum cases, and all of those asylum cases begin in the administrative process. So having an understanding of administrative law and the way administrative law operates in some meta sense, I think is a good tool to have at your in your sort of awareness about how you're approaching these particular bodies, because they are bureaucracies like almost any government agency that you might come into contact with, whether you're working in international law here in the United States in the State Department or wherever it is as you're working. Administrative law penetrates almost every thing that we do when we're doing it in the domestic courts, and that has a lot to do with how international law is going to be into the U.S. legal system. So I think it's useful. It doesn't, I would say day to day, though, that what's much more pragmatic is what does it mean to go through that system? How does it look when you encounter it? What does it mean to talk to an administrative judge who is an immigration judge, which are administrative law officials that have a little bit different, they quack and talk differently than a federal court judge. And we spend a lot of time talking in clinic about the difference between appearing before an administrative judge in Arlington and the Inter-American Human Rights Commission in the OAS, in the Organization of American States, and how those two bodies differ, and why that's something that's useful to have in your toolkit as a lawyer when you go out into practice.
We did not touch on the experiential learning part of this, yeah, and where it sort of fits into how you sort of plan it out yourself. Maybe you want to, because we haven't said a word about
it. Yeah, no, I'm happy to. I actually, when I was thinking about what I can contribute to advising, and we've done this in various constellations of these colleagues and others in the past on international law, I've kind of given general advice. I think the experiential part of what you do here is one of the things that is most valuable about this school. I think it's one of the opportunities that I'm sure you were probably aware of when you applied here, when you got in here and want to make part of what you do here. And some of those options are fairly overt, and I think you've seen, if any of you applied to clinic or applied to any of the other many options that we have in international work that include things like the Dean's UNCAT group, the PILPG, Paul Williams group that does that kind of work, the UNRO clinic. Those are all international law offerings that are clinic-like that you can do in mostly in your third year, but I think some people may be doing it as second-year students. I wouldn't be surprised if we have some second-year students who will end up in clinic, just given the constellation of applications that we had this year, and it changes every single year. So I think I can't begin to predict what the universe of the applicant pool is going to look like in any of these particular constellations, where I think the dean's view has been to make as many of those as widely available to you as possible so that you can do at least one while you're here. I think that's the idea behind it. That was one of the reasons, if any of you attended the sessions about experiential offerings that we have in the school, as opposed to clinical offerings, which is a little bit more narrow constellation. Those are useful things to think about. I think things like trial practice, which you can do in your second year, I believe, are options that you might want to consider if you're interested in experiential kinds of things, whether or not you picture yourself as a litigator. I think there are ways for you to try on lawyering in practice in a way that may address what is the most common concern that I have among students entering in the clinic, and I think in the clinical program in general, and that is your anxieties about performance, about standing up and arguing or making a clear set of points about an issue that has legal coherence and is sympathetic to a client or an issue that you want to argue about. You worry about that. What we all worry about. We don't want to look like fools when we open our mouth. So I think that's a legitimate thing to do, and there are lots of opportunities here to do that. Trial practice is one of them. It doesn't mean it's a must-take course, but it's a powerful experiential option that is useful, I think, in whatever work you may do in the future. Some of the experiential offerings, like the clinical offerings, are obvious. They're sort of on their face. That's they're going to be different than the kind of classroom components that you see. Others are kind of stuck And I remember a few years back when I was teaching a first year elective in international law, and I decided to, because I was a clinical teacher, I decided I didn't like them all lecture, so I decided to stick in some role playing and some activities that were non-passive for students to engage in during that. And I invited the international law faculty to talk about it, and was stunned to hear how many of you all do that in your classes, including your class where you do a lot of drafting and very practical kinds of exercises in business transactions and those kinds of things. I don't know about your classes.
Maybe
with
you can talk to me. I do that in probably every topic.
In the international law class.
I'm hearing you say that.
The point is not whether or not you do it, but for you all to be exploring the places where you can find those opportunities. Because I have to tell you, for me in law school, doing case method got pretty old after the first year. And when you come back into another class where you're sitting with a casebook, marching through the briefing of your cases, again and again and again, it can get pretty tiring. And so I liked the things I loved in law school myself were any opportunities I got to do something experiential. And sometimes you can see it by the name of the course. We have courses called interviewing, counseling, and negotiation. There are an array of those kinds of courses that are very pragmatic by the title of the course. But some aren't so obvious, and you either can glean it from the course description or talk to the professor or talk to your colleagues about the places where experiential learning goes on here and seek those out. I think the critique of law schools today for their failure to teach you how to practice law is a very salient critique. It's a legitimate kind of critique that we should take very seriously. And I think this school has taken very seriously for a very long time. And so one of the things that I think you benefit from in being at this school is the confluence of the strength that we have in our international law program. In fact, I think the difficulty isn't ever in my talking to individuals. It isn't ever finding the classes. It's deciding between the 50 that you can choose from, and trying to make sure that doesn't compete with the other things you want to take and the other kinds of activities that you want to undertake that are going to include, I would suggest, an externship, other experiential kinds of learning that you can do outside of the building. I mean, my ideal sort of constructive path through law school would include something like an externship in your second year that helps you prepare for the more immersion kind of role as a lawyer in the clinical program in your third year with some other experiential courses sprinkled in. And I don't think that, to me, you can probably find those in international law. I'm sure you can find places where you can do that kind of work. But I think that's as valuable as the content. My mantra in these sessions has always been, this is law school that you are paying a lot of money to go here, and I'm not a big fan of those who advise students to take bar prep courses, right? I think that's the last thing. Now, you have just said that. But others. International law isn't on the bar. I'm a big fan of taking what you love and then figuring out what you need to do to pass the bar when you get to the bar review course. If all of you are smart enough to get in here, you can pass the bar. I can tell you that. Just the profile of the test-taking abilities that you have and the general grade point average of our student body, you can pass the bar. So taking a course because you think you need it for the bar, I think is not a great strategy. I have a stepson who's a second year student at NYU Law School, and he is doing that as we speak. I mean, he's taking, you know, tax and corporations because he doesn't want to have to deal with them in the bar review course. These are precious hours. I can tell
you. Okay, I'm going to offer a contrary.
Okay.
I don't disagree with anything, but I actually think that you don't know when you're in law school necessarily what you're going to end up doing when you graduate. And I do worry sometimes about students who just see all the human rights questions.
Right.
And I speak as a lawyer. And so it is great to sort of take classes to get excited about and nourish your intellectual curiosity. But I also think there's something to be said for trying to be somewhat well-rounded for a variety of reasons. Maybe from us, the reasons that Professor Anderson and I mentioned earlier, which is that you're going to be a better international lawyer if you know certain areas of international law really, really well. But students, as we all are surprised by what we understand. I mentioned earlier that I didn't take international law class when I was in law school.
Nor did I.
And faculty got a bunch of incompetence.
No, seriously, it just wasn't, you didn't do it.
I did take it, but it was at 8:30 in the morning.
I don't think international law was invented when I went to law school.
you don't necessarily know what's going to get you excited, and students often discover to their surprise that a class they didn't expect to like turns out to be fascinating stuff. So I would encourage you to try to get some balance.
Meaning taking sort of the bar courses are valuable because somebody has made the determination that those are a way to be well balanced.
Yeah, I feel like that must have been like that. I was thinking as you were talking, I took some of the classes like corporations.
Right.
And I don't remember whether in my mind that was bar prep or just something everybody said you should take, but the two probably become the same thing. Mm-hmm. I was stunned with how interesting they were and what you so much they were.
Yeah.
I ended up practicing a little bit in international preparation. There's something to be said for forcing yourself to get out of your comfort zone as well.
True. I confess, I like tax when I do personally know that when I do it in law school.
Yeah.
Right. But I also would say I haven't used it since I graduated and probably avoided it because I didn't think that was a strength that I brought to my legal practice. So, I don't know. I don't know whether it was wasted my tuition dollars or not. And I'll leave it to you to make your decision about that. I think that's it. I think everything, Diane. That last one.
Yeah, I think that's some questions.
I'm interested in the international courts class. You were talking about the international law being kind of good, kind of broad, covering everything. Is that similar with international courts?
This is John. They would. I think this is taught by one of the law libraries who's been teaching it for years and years and years. And it's a kind of an introduction. It's almost like the course that you have about this is an international organization. Just the courts end of things. I think it's a useful course. It gives you a sort of overview of the way that different international tribunals operate mechanically, which I think is very useful to you if you're interested in that. Practice area. I think there is a course. I think we still offer. I don't know whether you teach it still, but you did teach international organization at some time. And we do, and that's a broader kind of thing that looks at institutions and starts
starts with the UN and works your way through regional organizations and structures. I've always felt like the thing that students in clinic lack the most, because you spend all of your time immersed in holdings of cases and the rules of law, is the structure, is the superstructure of how things operate and what it means to walk in the door of the building and figure out where you're going to go first and what happens. And those courses give you that superstructure. So those are, I think, very valuable.
I'm going to be interested in working in a foreign service at some point. So do you have any recommendations based on that? Gosh, I feel like I should. Can you give me your email afterwards? And I'll call one of my former staff at the State Department and ask them how they find Chicago. It hasn't been part of my own career trajectory. I don't know. I know that I depended very, very heavily on the Foreign Service. Mm-hmm. What advice they would
have given.
I'll get that.
There have been maybe, from our clinic, human rights clinic graduates, there have probably been half a dozen people who have gone to the Foreign Service. And of course, the first hurdle is the exam, and that's I think is, everybody agrees that. I mean, you got to get through that, which is rigorous, to say the least, I think requires a breadth of knowledge that I doubt if I have about for foreign affairs and such. And then
it could
happen. I'm telling you, it's kind of random. It's difficult. And then of course, from running in, I've run into a couple of my students while traveling abroad who are working with a consulate or the embassy abroad, and most of them say, you know, it sounds romantic, but where you get assigned and how often you have to change, and I think it requires that you have a willingness to go anywhere and pretty much to change locations at any time. And I think that's one of the real challenges. I think you all imagine that world travel and exotic places are a real pull for you in terms of international law, and they may well be, but once you get out of law school and you kind of want to get your career going in one direction, it's much harder to think about just pulling up roots and going to name the place. Serbia, I don't know, wherever it is that you decide you're going to spend, how many years out of school? Your career, back and forth, I don't know. I think that can be terrific. People who do it love it, and others say, gosh, we want to be this uprooted, this vagabondage. Yeah.
Professor Anderson, for private national law, how important is checking the typical boxes of corporate law, such as like journal, MOOC, things like that, to have firms look at you?
I'm not sure that
what I would say to that would achieve in the opinion school.
Here's the problem, is your interest is purely transactional. We have, for example, our up and growing business law journal, fabulous new journal, sort of grew in the last few years. The International Law Review will also be very happy to run lots of international business articles and student notes on these things for us. I think that there is a question when students look at journals, if they're looking to be purely mercenary about it. So in other words, not a clinical journal as such, but it's purely what's in it to me. What they're getting out of it is a sort of check off the box to be able to say to a potential employer that I've done well. And
And then there is the question of what you're getting out of it in terms of research skills and reading, writing skills, that sort of stuff. And I think that realistically that is probably less than that should be the case. And I think that's the problem of law journals in general.
The support for the work you're doing.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Academic support.
And the more transactional the areas that you're interested in, then the more limited, I would say, the amount of. Because the journals are mostly about cases and mostly about court processes and things like that. I'm not these days necessarily anymore, but kind of writing into that. If you don't have a background in business, finance, accounting, those kinds of areas, you might wind up concluding that your time is better off spent getting that background than spending time on journal. But that said, there are an awful lot of employers out there who might look to you if you don't have a journal and check off. So I think it really is true. So the trade-offs involved there in terms of just the amount of time the journal does take, and necessarily so, because it's just a huge job to get the stuff out there. Given the fact that we turn stuff in, not as professors, not entirely complete.
I think
I'm sure he's never done that.
No, never.
When all is still pending.
Right.
Yes.
Don't remind me.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think that business about the firm looking for the box about the law review stuff. It's a shorthand way for them to say, oh, well, this person must be able to write if they were in a journal. It's a sort of a Pavlovian response, and I'm not sure it's true anymore, given the proliferation of journals and given the general lack of support for it. I think if you're a good writer and you can sort of reinforce those habits, it could be useful. I don't know. How many of you tried to writing onto a journal?
Bunch of
yeah, a lot of you. My first year lecture class, it seemed like there were a whole lot of people who were writing on over spring break, right? You guys were all writing on over spring break. What a great way to spend spring break.
I'm sure.
I don't know. I agree with Ken. I'm not sure the return on the investment is worth it, but there is that, you know, it's a great thing on your calling card when you're talking to firms, not big firms in the particular area of law you want to practice in.
And increasingly government employees.
My concerns about it are really sort of structural in ways that are really sort of, you can't sort of make the thing work right. I don't think there's enough writing for the students. I think there's too much sort of scut work that's involved. I think the commitment of time is actually too large, at least if you're a school that's located in Washington, D.C., and it's not in a perfect government. There's nothing else to do, so please.
But in other words, if you have to make
choices, the types of things that Professor Wilson's describing,
those are all very time intensive as well, and so it's actually kind of a tough thing to figure out.
Same with moods, I'd say. Move towards her. I think I had one student this year in clinic who took part in two foreign competitions where she was gone for a week each, and that was just for the oral round, and let alone whatever else she was doing. She slept a lot in class. I think it was
you forgave her.
Yes, right, I forgave her.
I saw him.
Over here.
Yeah.
If we're interested in international development as more of a long-term career goal, would it be better to develop the academic foundation in private or public? Because they do intersect with the human rights and the investment questions. And so I'm like, is it better to get a sort of structure in one of the sides then?
I'd like to move
there.
No, I don't. I think law is kind of flummoxed by development as an area. I think it's, I have a lot of students who are interested in it, and I think more and more all the time. And it is kind of a hybrid. I think it what I've seen is that it's worked better with the sort of combination degree with SIS and career and doing the dual degree, because it gives you exposure to more policy-based kinds of courses. But I don't know that I have an easy answer. That's why I was sighing. I have actually a long side career in international development, which is exactly the reasons that the whole set here intersects with the law school almost not at all. In other words, as the chair of the board of a couple of large development organizations with large budgets, and to the extent that it intersects with law, it's entirely in my background as a nonprofit lawyer and corporate governance of nonprofits. That's a pretty good area. But the rest of it is business, finance, management, all of those kinds of areas, much less so of law. And I think that what's partly happening is the interest of learning law students in the area and law professors in the area is driving an attempt by the law professors to invent the field in the area. Somebody that's working in the field a lot, I don't really think exists there. And it potentially risks sort of diverting resources. Okay, so what happens in that area? We talk an awful lot about institutions, corruption, governance, and things like that, all of which are hugely crucial to development. But if you ask me as a practitioner in the field, it's not a law practitioner, it's that I know the finance of the law, and I'm able to sit down with possible people and work through their business plan and work through their capital projections. There's some very common and none of that stuff is really.
I second that absolutely, and I would say, given what you were kind of leading towards when you were kicking off the courses, I would say, if you asked the question, was is it more private than public? I would say it's probably more private than public. I would
more
say,
more finance, actually. Yeah. You have to understand money.
Right. And probably the most important course that I think would be relevant to anybody that wanted to be in international development.
We have an offering in. We have an international development class somewhere in Korea.
An art professor is still with South Africa.
Is that right?
Danny
Bradlow, and then
who's the?
Yes.
Monsali.
Daniel Bradlow has been a long time head of the International Legal Studies Program in all of these sort of areas. But he would be the first to tell you that his international development work depends upon his knowledge of international finance. Things like infrastructure projects and running my areas and microfinance and that stuff. There's not a lot of law involved in that stuff. It's all basically numbers and balance sheets.
Other questions?
You do want to take a job.
Can you still look at
there's a job? There is, yeah.
We do all like that too.
Yeah.
And SIS me.
Well, listen, you're looking at me that way, but I can tell you, if you come and take any of my classes, you're going to hear that on a weekly basis. Nicole, have you heard me say this?
Never.
I don't think we figured out a way to kind of fit it into the sort of existing schema of the way we talk about public international law. Who knows? Maybe we'll come up with a new specialization in development law.
Great question.
It is. But the way to think about this curriculum is that we have sort of the public law side, the human rights side, the law of war side, all of this kind of stuff, and then we have the private law side. And basically what we're saying is you have to get a ground in money and violence.
Money and violence. Think money and violence if you're signing up for your...
That was a joke, folks.
That's serious. I'm trying to figure out what you're going to sign up for.
We are.
Give a call. Again, my apologies for coming a half hour late.
All right, thank you.